This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by OnX Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Download the Hunt app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Know where you stand with OnX.
Okay, Tim Sly, tell us what are we gonna do? We're gonna milk out the introduction. Tell what is an epidemiologist? I mean, I mostly kind of know, but tell everybody else. Tell Giannis.
Okay, the word doesn't have anything to do with illness. Epi means around, demos means people, and ology is the study of it. Somehow we've put diseases onto that, but it goes back to Aristotle, actually Hippocrates in the old days. Anything that was visited upon a population from outside, such as a plague or warts or something like that, was investigated.
Warts are visited from the outside?
Well, sure they were. I mean, they didn't have warts yesterday. Now today everybody's got warts. I mean, I just keep using that as an example. So diseases have taken over epidemiology, but in the original word, that had nothing to do with diseases.
Because they didn't know about them.
They had some spectacular ideas about where diseases came from.
They were supernatural. The miasma.
But the miasma was actually started by Hippocrates in a sort of a pretty reasonable way. Before that, it was the stars, demons, gods who were displeased with the evils of mankind, all kinds of devils and so on causing disease.
There's still people who think that.
Indeed. But then Hippocrates came along and said, look, forget the supernatural. Think of natural. So if you're living in a swampy area, you look at those people and again, they're more chance of having fever than the people who live on a nice, clear mountaintop. He was right. But it wasn't the smell in the swamp that did it. It was the mosquitoes that lived in the swamp. So yeah. He had the right solution for the right, but at least he brought supernatural down to natural. But we had miasma lasting until really the mid-1800s, until like Pasteur and Koch came along and found bacteria for the first time.
So it's now, it's miasma, not miasma.
You can pronounce it any way you like, yeah.
But that concept was the idea that there was just bad air.
Bad air. And of course, we get bad air with malaria. In Italian, malaere, bad air. So we still use the word bad air in the name of malaria.
Isn't it wild that they were people
smart.
Just getting like wiped out by malaria, not making the connection between that and mosquitoes for hundreds and hundreds of years?
And they knew the connection between stagnant, stale, collected water and disease, but they didn't know why. So they made the right solutions, but for the wrong reason.
Yeah. Well, tell me where. So you're an epidemiologist. You told us what it means. Where do you practice? What is your career?
Virtually anyway. My specialty is foodborne diseases, but my colleagues are sometimes clinical epidemiologists, and they help physicians in hospitals run randomized controlled trials. There's in occupational health epidemiologists who are really trying to study diseases in the workplace, because remember, workers are exposed to 100 times more problems than the citizens are. So normally the diseases emerge more in a worker working in a mine, in a forest, in a slaughterhouse, wherever it is. They're exposed to much more chemical plants, pharmaceutical plants. It's the workers where diseases begin to show up first. So we study them.
But why is that? Pardon the interruption.
Well, because they're exposed to more. I mean, if you're packing, I don't know, let's take Viagra in a pharmaceutical plant, you're breathing in this dust in an 8-hour shift every day for 30 years. You're exposed to far more of this incidental chemical than somebody who's in the citizenry who may just buy one a couple. I'm using Viagra as a strange example, but you can see that they're exposed to far more. People working in the vinyl chloride industry, making polyvinyl chloride, PVC. Those people began to fall like flies for a very rare liver disease, a hemangioma, that only affects people who work in the PVC industry.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's a polymer. Plastics are polymers, right?
Yeah.
You get gases and liquids and you polymerize them together to make a solid. That's where polyvinyl chloride. Vinyl chloride is a gas. It's highly carcinogenic. put the molecules together, you get polyvinyl chloride, which is pretty stable until you can incinerate it at the end of its life. Then it produces furans and dioxins. So it's dangerous at the beginning when you're making it, dangerous at the end when you're burning it, but it's okay in the middle.
So this is probably a misconception I had about, remember I told you I knew all about it and I was going to have you tell Giannis? I didn't know about it. I had the misconception that I thought epidemiology, was that you only looked at infectious diseases that like spread from person to person.
In the early days, Steve, you'd be right. And people were worried about plague and they're worried about horrible disease like anthrax and typhoid and that. And it's still a major part of things. I mean, those diseases haven't gone away. They're still around. But more and more epidemiology looks at even accidents. You look at heart disease and cancers. Now, we have a few infectious cancers around. The first one was the feline leukemia virus. In other words, a virus that can infect something cause cancer. Human papillomavirus, which you know, you get your kids vaccinated for HPV, and it almost will wipe out future cervical cancer.
Yeah, that's the one that's like a little bit controversial because people feel that little kids will get vaccinated and they'll be more likely to become like sexually promiscuous knowing that they don't have
to
worry about
it.
Yeah, it's like this kind of like funny logic where there's a thing like you can get what's it called?
HPV.
HPV. So you could vaccinate your child for is it a venereal disease?
It's a virus.
The virus.
It's spread through sexual contact.
Yeah.
But you got to get the kids before the first contact with the virus, which means guaranteed before the first sexual contact.
That's right. And some people argue like, oh, I don't want my kid to get it because then they'll be like, that the only thing keeping their kid from being sexual is the fear of HPV, apparently. And so then you give them...
It's pretty weak logic, yeah.
I see this idea floating around out there. It always strikes me as funny. You specialize in foodborne.
Mm-hmm.
How do you... I've had a number of foodborne things that I'd like to talk about. But how do you sort of encapsulate what would be foodborne? Is it like, does it mean like that you have to ingest it, or is it exposure to the food system that you could get? Or does foodborne illness have to mean that you physically ingested it in your mouth and swallowed it?
Yeah.
To be foodborne.
Ingested. Food or water, yeah.
Food or water that gets ingested.
No, there are some diseases which you can, like tularemia, for example, you know, rabbit fever.
That's where I was going with this.
That one is a mainly foodborne disease, but you can also get it through cuts on the skin and through inhaling through an aerosol. That's a very versatile organism, but mainly it's foodborne disease. You're ingesting it, whether it's a toxin in the food, whether it's a bacteria, a parasite, a fungus, or a virus, or just a plain old chemical. They're all foodborne diseases.
I want to walk through a whole bunch of diseases I'm interested in and that apply to sort of outdoor people. And I want to start with tularemia because there's a thing like, you guys can back me up on this. People have this idea there's something wrong with rabbits, right?
But it's only wrong with rabbits before the first freeze of the year, and there's all sorts of old wives' tales about
it. Dude, I carried around with me. My kid killed a rabbit the other day with his little stick bow. And he's walking around with it all, I mean, like I would argue overhandling it. And it's summertime, and I'm like, you know, I know from growing up that one doesn't handle a rabbit before the first frost. And then I remember reading a couple years ago about a guy that ran over a desiccated rabbit with his lawnmower and got like an aerosolized tularemia.
Right. No shit.
His lungs.
Yeah.
Poor bastard.
Yeah. Walk us through like what's wrong with rabbits and when?
It's not just rabbits. In fact, if you track it right down to its origin, the reservoir, if you want to call it that, for a disease in this case is the tick. Usually ticks. See, the ticks, rabbits happen to be close to the ground. The rabbits happen to pick up more ticks than most other animals out there. So they become infected with it. So that if you catch a rabbit, you skin a rabbit, you touch a rabbit, you run over it with a lawnmower or whatever, you're either going to have contact with the skin, you're going to breathe in the aerosol, or if you do cook it up and you have a rabbit pie, during the preparation of it, you can, that bacteria, Francisella tularensis, you're going to ingest it into your body and take in the body in some way or another. If it's on the skin, you'll get like an ulcer, a rather nasty indurated ulcer. It's called an ulcerans type.
Does it have to enter through a cut?
That's how it does. It's a very active little bacteria, Francisella, and it enters through a cut. And most people got little cuts on the skin that you don't notice about it. And so that's the skin form, which is easy to treat. Less easy to treat is the inhaled form. So it forms a form of chronic pneumonia, quite nasty. And then if you eat the meat, you can get a gastrointestinal disease. It's a very versatile organism. You find it all over the place. But the tick is where you go first.
Okay, walk me through the life cycle of a tularemia bacteria. What, like, so if you had a rabbit that lived, in sort of a isolated, somehow you could isolate a rabbit from ticks.
Right.
So he's living a normal rabbit life, eating normal rabbit stuff, but for whatever reason, this is some magical land where he doesn't come into contact with a tick.
Right.
He never gets tularemia?
If he's not bitten by a mosquito, because that's another way to transfer the organism, and he doesn't come across mice or rats, maybe field mice, deer mice, or something like that, which can also carry it. And the rabbits don't normally eat these things. So that it's, yeah, you're right. If he doesn't get bitten or by a tick or a mosquito and doesn't come into contact, yes, he would be virtually free.
Can you get rabbit? Let's say you're hanging out, a mosquito bites a rabbit. And then a mosquito bites you. That doesn't transmit tularemia, right?
Well, the mosquito would have to have been bitten. Have to have bitten something first, another infective rabbit or other animal to infect the rabbit. It doesn't come from just the mosquito or the tick. I mean, it has to have bitten some other animal
that
to transfer
had
it. So gotcha. the big reservoir, is the wildlife out there. Now, of course, if you get it, you're not going to transfer it to anybody else unless you give blood.
Mm-hmm.
Or unless somebody eats you, cannibalism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's very rare. But why
is it known as rabbit fever? Well, I never heard of anybody, people don't exercise caution when they're cleaning squirrels out of fear of getting tularemia.
Squirrels can get it too. So can the smaller rodents as well, larger animals too. In fact, they've even found it in birds, water birds, you know, cranes and things. And I believe there's some people who say they found it in fish, too. There's an example of tularemia just in California a couple of years ago with a fish hook. Apparently, the fish hook was in a fish, and somebody then sort of tried to cast the hook again. It got caught in somebody's skin.
Yeah.
And that was the origin of the Francisella organism again.
No.
Yeah. This is a very versatile.
I think it was a fly tied out a rabbit hair. What do you think about that, Sam?
Oh,
fisherman.
I don't like thinking about that one bit. I tie with rabbit hair all the time. I will tan my own rabbit hides to make flies.
Well, the hair is not going to be a problem.
No,
it's the flesh.
Right,
it's
never
the
mind.
Organism.
Never mind.
Well, you got to deal with the
never
flesh.
Never mind that theory.
You got to deal with the flesh to get the hair, if you're doing it yourself.
That's true,
Does cooking rabbit meat kill tularemia?
Yeah.
Do you happen to know? I'll forgive you if you don't. At what temperature tularemia gets killed?
Oh, it's not very heat stable. So technically probably about 145°F, but I would take it up to about 160 to be on the safe side, because you can't really be sure you're killing everything in there. 160.
Yeah, a lot of magic when it comes to food, a lot of magic happens around 160, don't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You also lose a lot of magic out of some foods if you're going to take it to 160.
Well, it's a give and take, right?
Yeah, absolutely. An elk steak taken to 160 is going to be like shoe leather.
Well, you could try. You know what's coming in now is the sous vide method of cooking.
Oh, yeah, man.
Down to about 140, 135, but for a long time.
Prolonged periods
of
time.
But that needs our microbiologist to begin to say, look, you can cook with this thing. It needs, say, 2.5 hours to kill the bacteria off. I mean, I think you've had, you've had trichinosis, haven't you?
Me and Yanni here.
Both of you have.
We're positive.
Well, now
we even got T-shirts to say "Trick Pause."
That may have been a great piece of semi-raw beef at that moment, but there's a problem with it, So they're taken up to the reasonable temperature, or irradiating it or really freezing it. And freezing doesn't work all the time with trichinosis. We've got some new strains now in the Arctic area.
That's what I wanted to add. Cause, so we're jumping into trichinosis right now. We're just going, we're
if
going
you want
for
to,
it.
You're okay. The boss.
When we were struggling with our little trichinosis problem, which really isn't that bad, it's a bad week, mm-hmm. but it causes a lot of psychological harm mm-hmm. because you know, you can't like ask your buddy what happened to him when he had it. So it's unnerving. But in the end, in hindsight, it's not a big deal. However,
it can be a big deal.
It can kill you, right?
It can kill you. But for most people, it's mild and achy and joint pain and so on. But if it gets in the eye and the liver and the heart and stuff like that,
it can be bad news.
It can be bad. There was an outbreak in 2008 in California.
An outbreak?
Outbreak. 39 people met to sample bear meat.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And all of those, the epidemiologists,
they
did
met,
all the figures.
They, so
they had
I
a,
bet they met
they
for something else.
No, they had a feast for bear meat.
Okay, go on.
And there was some would only eat cooked bear meat, and the majority ate raw or semi-cooked. And 100% of the people who ate the uncooked, the raw meat, developed trichinosis.
Really?
And the studies were fascinating. For example, there's not much meat left.
How have I never even heard about this?
You didn't? I'll give
what
you,
year
I'll,
was this?
I'll send you the
reprint.
Oh,
no, I'm not
reprint.
Calling, I'm not no, calling no, you out like you're lying.
You can read through the whole thing.
Yeah, okay.
Fascinating study.
Okay, go on.
But they all the meat they had left was some of the claw, the paw of the bear. And for 1 gram of that meat, they isolated 76 or 78 trichinosis worms. And 1 gram, that's about the size of a garbanzo, you know, a chickpea.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the predilective site for that particular organism. It really gets to the masseter muscles, you know, the big chewing muscles,
yeah.
to the diaphragm and the heart. All those wandering parasites, that's where they go. So this is going to be
Can I tell
much...
you, can I one up you real quick?
What's that?
Well, I had to send a chunk of my bear meat down to the CDC in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It was, well, I remember I calculated it out to the pound.
Yeah.
It was 600,000 larvae per pound.
That's about right. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe now, I'm not one up. Anymore.
Now remember, take it next step. All of those larvae are going to get into your gut and your stomach acid is going to dissolve the little cyst that comes out. So now they're free swimming. The female's about 2 millimeters. The male's about 1 millimeter, very, very tiny. In your gut, they're mating.
Mm-hmm.
And each pair now produce thousands of larvae that are microscopic. They enter through the gut wall, through the blood supply, and go around the body. So by that time, you've got billions of larvae in you now from the hundreds of thousands that you ate. We're talking astronomical numbers here.
Do they... Is the heart is your heart and diaphragm and tongue? Did you say tongue when you talked about hot spots?
Tongue is one, especially for tapeworm.
Okay, so it's not a trick hot spot.
Not a trick hot spot. No, masses is heart and the diaphragm and tongue.
Okay, is it that
put them in there?
Is it that they is it that it's a good habitat for them and they survive there, or do they know to go there?
They don't know to go there.
But so it's just the ones that go there do well.
The circulation system runs into these tissues first. I mean, the heart muscle needs a lot of fresh oxygenated blood. So right from the lung, it gets into the heart wall. And so you're seeing a lot end up there. But I don't know why the masseter muscle, why the chewing muscles would be. It is a case for quite a few parasites, wandering parasites.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Hmm. You know where we felt the pain?
Yeah.
Back me up, Yanni, but... what am I touching right now?
The scapula?
No.
Shoulder blade?
No, the muscle that like connects your shoulders to
the
neck.
Deltoid.
Trapezius?
Your traps?
Yeah.
Don't nod, Yanni. People can't hear you nod.
Yeah, I would agree with traps.
Your calves?
Yeah, the calves, yeah.
And then lower back.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
You back me up? That's where you could feel the pain.
Really?
But I don't know that that really means that that's where the bugs are going, the worms.
Just the ones that are making their presence felt on you. That's all.
Yeah, yeah, I see.
Now, if we only had like basically a shish kebab type chunk each, that's how much I had. You might have had more.
A couple shishes.
So we might have not made it to hundreds of thousands.
Mm.
because we ate very little that day.
Just on the plane coming down, out of interest, I was looking at the range of meat, bear meat, that was eaten by these 39 people. It ranged from about a half an ounce to one person at 28 ounces.
Right? That person really liked that raw bear.
So, if you figure it out to the next cycle of life, they're into billions and billions of these things.
Yeah, that's a
big, that guy was going for
that's
it.
A big
and
boy.
So what happens is it forms an inflammation, but instead of an inflammation being a little local inflammation, the entire body is one massive inflammation. So your chemicals that respond to, you know, the cytokines respond to all the inflammation are just making you a febrile mass of jelly. And so you can't keep up with the blood pressure and the heart would stop. That's what kills you. But it's unusual to be that amount.
You know what piqued my interest there is, when earlier I was saying, I think before we started to record, I was saying that I had occasion to interact with the state epidemiologist in Alaska while this was going on. And we got to chatting. And he mentioned that there's sort of a famous version of trichinosis, or people always I might mutilate the word, like trichinosis spiralis, trichinella spiralis.
Trichinella spiralis. That's the original one.
Okay. And he was saying there are a variety of these. Everybody always says that one, but there's a variety of these. And he suggested that there are freeze tolerant specimens in the north, and even told me about a case he worked on where some people had eaten raw walrus that had been frozen for the winter, and they thought it was safe because it was frozen. But in fact, he feels that they tracked the infection to raw walrus. What surprised me about this was two things. One, that a walrus would be a potential carrier of trichinosis. I don't know why that surprised me, but it just seems unusual. And two, that freezing doesn't kill it, because you often will see people say, cook it or freeze it for a long time. And he was saying that he's a proponent of cooking, not trusting the freezing.
Cooking, or if you really want to be bold, radiation will do it as well. Cobalt-60 will do it. It won't hurt the meat, but it'll kill off everything that's in it.
Is that something people do?
Oh, yeah. We do it with spices, for example. People don't know that. The spices you buy in the supermarket
have been irradiated.
Yeah, yeah.
Really? For safety? And,
For food safety. And in fact, the public would be up in arms about it, because they think they're going to turn, luminous at night or something, but it's not. Many countries do it for things like onions. You don't get onions sprouting, or potatoes won't sprout.
Come on, with cobalt-60?
Cobalt, there's a number of isotopes you can do. It's much like an X-ray machine. You know, you put the food in little packages, you run it through the machine, you irradiate, it comes out the other end. There's nothing, no radioactivity in the food. But just like the X-ray has gone through your foot when you X-ray your foot, it's gone through the food, zapped everything alive in there. Now, you can't do it with things like bean sprouts, because you want the bean sprout to be alive. You want the seed still to grow into it. You can't do something like that. But if you want to kill off anything that's alive in there, you irradiate it. It's wonderful. It's done for the armed services all over the world.
So you could take bear meat, run it through that whatever contraption they do this in, and then just have like...
They would have to figure out for that particular trichinella exactly how much what the intensity would be for that. Once they've got that sorted out, and you'd be safe as houses. Then you could eat all the raw bear meat you want. Taste wouldn't change, but you'd be safe.
So one thing we've been talking about lately, because we tend to talk about trichinosis probably too much, is that you mentioned sous vide cooking. And I've read, and people have emailed me various things where people are like, oh, you can, instead of hitting 160 or 165, you can actually kill it at 140 for a prolonged period of time. Is this sort of, is information like that, and if you don't know the exact numbers, that's fine. I'm not asking you to give them. But is information like that set forth in some sort of official way around sous vide and trichinosis? Like, are you aware of someone formally saying, yes, 6 hours at 140, you're 100% absolutely safe? Or are these numbers still a little bit elusive?
They're very elusive. I don't know the answer for trichinosis. I don't know anybody does, but we were talking about it, and I think it's a good way to go. The whole process is new. It's in the last, couple of decades that people have been interested in doing this. And so, but you need to look at every single one of those organisms. There's about 250 agents that give you foodborne disease, and each one of them would have to be assessed because you're right at the margin. You're right at the edge. I mean, a minute or two too short in time, and you can have problems.
Yeah.
A degree or two too low in temperature. You're right on the edge of the thing. So you've got to be really sure about the science of it. But once that's done for all of these agents, then people stick to it, I think we're going to be okay. And there may be somewhere in there, trichinella will be tested for that as well.
This is kind of an obvious question. Well, no, it's not, because I don't even know the answer to it. Pick any kind of thing pick your favorite foodborne pathogen that dies at a certain temperature. What happens at, like, why does it die? What happens to some of these things? Like, you boil water to sanitize water, whatever. Like, what goes on with the organism that makes it that it can't get you sick anymore?
Main thing is protein. You take an egg, you put it in the frying pan, it's still moving around, heat it up to it, about 143 F, whatever the temperature is. I'm converting from Celsius to Fahrenheit, and suddenly the protein coagulates, becomes white protein, becomes a solid, doesn't function as a protein. You're getting all kinds of protein chains separating and connecting again. In other words, protein's useless, and we're all made of protein. So mainly it's the heat that's disabling the protein every single time. And that whatever the protein is you're trying to disable, the temperature is slightly different for each one.
Okay.
This is why mad cow disease was the mystery, because we found out that's a protein. It's a pure protein. It's not even a virus or anything. But we find that you can heat that to temperatures that no other protein on the planet would survive, and yet this thing does.
Yeah, I heard about some politician that said it was a private meeting. I don't want to name who said it, but he had said he was talking about CWD wasn't an issue because we'll just everybody have to cook their deer meat more. And some guy's like, you got to cook your deer meat to 4,000 degrees.
You got to ash it. That's what you. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've got examples of probes used by a brain surgeon just to explore your brain. And for somebody who was suffering from early stages of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the human CJD, and that's all that happened, this probe, stainless steel probe, just went into the brain, and then they sewed him back up, and he's fine. The probe went through hospital sterilization three separate times. You know, that's a 15 pounds pressure, that's 121 C, that's 250 F, right, for 15 minutes. It'll kill off everything on the planet. This was still infective after three of those cycles.
Really?
Animals, you could give mad cow disease to hamsters three times. So you can't destroy this thing.
Sam, our very own special Sam Lundgren, explain how...
Are you leaving trichinosis?
Yeah.
I can't leave trichinosis.
You have at it, man. I'm just trying to move through a lot of sicknesses, but I want to...
We got it in 2013, I believe. So now I have billions of cysts in some of my major muscle groups.
They tend to die off.
Right.
After a while, if nobody eats you.
Right.
They tend to calcify. They tend to become non-viable. So even if somebody were to take a lump out of your calf muscle, they wouldn't suffer from it.
At what point? By now?
I think it varies quite a bit. There's been some work done in animals, because you can't really experiment on humans too much. The work done in animals, and I think it begins to a year or two, and they're pretty much sure it's gone.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, that's such a... I like thinking of myself as trick pies, man.
But you may get exceptions to the rule. You know, nature, don't underestimate Mother Nature. There's always exceptions. If somebody's going to keep them alive longer.
You know what? Pass this along to your colleagues.
Yeah.
We know our infection date. Like, we could tell you the day, like the day that we ingested the meat.
Okay. And when did you first have the symptoms?
A month later. We could tell you the day we ingested. We'd have to dig around, but we could get you the day. We could tell you the day we ingested the meat. Yeah. We could tell you the day that we had the onset of symptoms.
And the first symptoms were not like the latter symptoms, were they?
No.
Yeah.
We didn't have
first symptoms.
It evolved. I first started feeling like I had muscle fatigue.
But everything happened a month into it.
Nothing happened to four of us got sick. Nothing happened to any of us until a month later, and then we simultaneously had there was some common themes, some variants from person to person, but some strong common themes of muscle fatigue, and then we all got better pretty quick. And then we know we were a CDC reported case. They had the meat. Anyway, point being, if you're ever talking to any colleagues and they want to do a biopsy, absolutely would love to do it. If someone wanted to check where they got a known infection date and they wanted to see what's going on inside my calves or whatever, I would love to do a biopsy.
I'd give them a chunk of myself too.
Yeah, me and Yanni.
All they need is about a 0.1 of a gram.
Would love to do it. If you're ever at a conference and run into someone who's interested in trick.
Well, normally after about half a month to 3 weeks, you get gastrointestinal upset. And then it goes away a little bit. And then once the little larvae begin to spread throughout the system, that's about a month. And then you begin a month or two, and you begin to get the muscle aches and pains, joint pains, and so on.
Yeah, but you could just get the gastrointestinal upset. You know, that just happens for a thousand reasons, right? So that might not.
Didn't even notice.
We all might even didn't pay attention to it. Yeah. Like you get whatever, you have a bad day.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't the thing that really. A month later is when we really started texting each other.
Take your blood as well. They do a blood test. They're looking for serology, look for antigens to this particular parasite, and also for what they call eosinophilia. And it was looking for a certain kind of white blood cell. That when you have a parasite, it's suddenly there in vast numbers. It's not normally there in vast numbers. Parasites trigger the eosinophils in your blood. So there's a lot of blood work can be done as well as biopsies.
In order to tell that something's going on. Yeah. Okay, go on more, Yanni.
No, that's I'm happy.
You good?
That's what I wanted to hear.
Okay, Sam, explain the work you were doing that led us to get to talking about our guest, Tim.
Yeah, I was guy I used to work for, Lantani at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, taught me a trick where we're out fishing and you catch a trout.
Does this count as a trick?
No, it's not really a trick. nice. No, we were just out fishing. You catch a trout and chop it up and put in a bunch of lime juice and jalapenos and parsley and eat it with chips afterwards. And just
sort of like a ceviche.
It is a ceviche. That's what we call it. But everybody freaks out every time you talk about that. And
you wrote an article about it.
Yeah. Well, I wrote an article about it several years ago. We published a recipe for it in Backcountry Journal when I was there. And we got a lot of letters saying, oh, you shouldn't tell people to do that. It's so dangerous. You can't eat freshwater fish raw. Like across the board, you can't eat freshwater fish raw. And we did it again this spring. I posted some pictures of it and people freaked out again. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to look into this.
I'm surprised you're not dead.
I'm surprised I'm not dead too, especially with what you read online. I mean, there was one article from Vice News that the headline was like, eating freshwater fish will kill you.
Dude, that's where I go for all my news about food. All my wild game information comes from Vice.com.
It's bulletproof, and they're not trying to scare you at all. So I started looking into it, and the surface level review of it corroborated what everyone had said. Pretty much anywhere you look, people are going to say freshwater fish is not okay to eat raw. But I kept digging, and found one of Tim's responses on this website, Quora, about freshwater fish. And he said almost the opposite thing, that there are much more problems with marine fish than there are with freshwater fish. And so I reached out through a number of different mechanisms.
Is he not good about getting back to people?
No, he was.
No,
I was just on deadline.
I'll yell at him right now.
Yeah, no, no. Okay. And then we had a great conversation with that, about that. And he and someone as esteemed in his profession as him told me the exact opposite thing from what everybody had told me what I was reading online, and made me feel really good about eating freshwater fish raw and really sketched out about sushi. And then I told you that this guy's knows a lot about foodborne illnesses, and we talked about trichinosis and tularemia and a bunch of things, and I thought he'd be a great podcast guest.
Yeah, so I want to We can take turns. I want to ask about specific things that like that I hear about fish.
Yeah.
Okay. In Southeast Alaska, it's a commonly held belief. Go ahead and eat anything, any of the fish raw, but one dasn't eat a raw salmon, the worst being a raw king salmon, because you'll get worms and be all sick. You buying that? And that the halibut worms, don't worry about. The worms that proliferate in halibut, which I, when my wife asks what they are, I say that's just part of the halibut.
When I was working up there, man, the Dover sole and flounder would be bumpy with those worms.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at marine worms first, get them out of the way. There are many nematodes, the little round worms, some bigger than others, that affect marine fish. Sometimes people call them a cod worm. They belong to the genus like a Pseudoterranova, Anisakis, Phocanema. These are the worms. And we've all eaten them by the hundreds, not even knowing it, because normally the fish we buy in the supermarket is frozen or we've cooked it. But they only occur in marine fish. They go through a cycle. It varies a little bit. They go through either sort of seals and then back into fish, and then they're like the adult on the larva, adult on the larva. If we eat raw marine fish, there is a chance. It's not very common, but there is a chance that you can ingest one of these worms. Let's call an Anisakis, the most common one. Forms a little coil up, a little bit bigger than your trichinosis coil. And if it's raw, you can eat it, and it'll come out of its little cyst. It'll wonder what the hell's going on. It'll start to penetrate through the wall of your intestine. It'll wander around your guts for a while and then die. In other words, we cannot be the definitive host for that. It's looking for a seal, and we're not a seal. So it will die. En route, it can do little bits of damage. It can cause little bits of pain. It can even, in the rare cases, set up a peritonitis, an inflammation of the gut, or even an appendicitis, for example, just because it's poking its way into the wrong area. But it will die. It's called a visceral larva migrans, a VLM, by that stage.
So you're not going to all of a sudden like puke up a bunch of these things?
It's happened in Nova Scotia and northern Canada. A bunch of people had a fire at the beach.
They gathered to eat raw.
A lot of the fish they eat raw. And then after they went to the tent, one of the women is coughing, and up comes these worms, little worms. By that time, they've uncoiled themselves. They're about a centimeter
long. But they hadn't reproduced in her.
No. They can't.
She just ingested them.
They can't.
And is that because they're... ultimate host is like a saltwater biome.
It's a marine mammal.
So our system is more freshwater, and they can't.
It's very particular proteins that these parasites want, and we don't have the seals' protein. Look at the whales and seals and walrus, different marine mammals for different species of worm, but that's what they're looking for between the fish and the mammal. We are an incidental host, a dead end host. Now,
you can just weave this into whatever you're going to go into next, but you say like he roams around and dies. How long are we talking about? Like, let's say you eat a piece of raw salmon and get a worm.
Oh, a matter of days, week or so. But here's the thing. In the outside of Japan, if you like sushi.
And I do.
All the meat has been frozen. It's a kind of an agreed way to deal with meat, especially if you live, Toronto is 1,000 miles from the ocean. Here, you're a long way from the ocean. So if you're going to get really fresh fish, you want it frozen on the fishing boat and then only thawed out when it's in your sushi chef's hands. Mm-hmm. That's really fresh stuff. And that doesn't mean it keeps fresh. It also means it's killed off the worm. Those worms are killed off by freezing.
And that's useful for a lot of people, but... us and many people of our audience like to get those fish ourselves. Yep. And one thing I came across in this research is that the freezing level required to kill many of these parasites is much lower than you can attain.
Than your household freezer.
Exactly.
That'll be the case for Trichinella for sure. But most of these other worms are fairly easily killed off by freezing.
Oh, really?
But some species of fish are vastly more wormy than others. Hmm. And there are other worms I didn't mention, the much longer ones. For example, yellowtail tuna has got some rather large worms in there. You can have, you can see them. They're very macroscopic.
And they can mess you up.
No, they're going to be a dead end in you. But yeah. They're a bit objectionable to see this sort of wriggling thing, like a little bit of spaghetti, you know, in the raw sushi. But this is why most of the fish outside of Japan is frozen before it reaches the sushi chef.
I read in Japan that something like a quarter of the cases of appendicitis are actually mistaken cases of the Anisakis infection.
Exactly.
Yeah, so people go to the hospital and they're like, oh, we got to get your appendix out. And then, oh, no, you just have... gut full of worms.
Yeah. Sushi worms.
Yeah. So what sometimes is, what the surgeon sometimes does and finds out it wasn't the appendix, they'll whip out the appendix anyway. They've got the person open, and it'll stop the future. No, it doesn't always happen like that.
Yeah.
So what happened? Now, that's marine parasites.
Well, I'm not ready to move on yet.
Okay.
If you had to rate how me and Yanni here been eating a fair bit of raw yellowtail, not yellowfin, but yellowtail, which is a jack.
Okay.
Have never, like, right out of the damn water.
Okay.
Never frozen. Would you, if you were hanging out with us?
This is the sea fish, ocean fish.
Ocean fish.
Yeah.
Ocean fish.
Ocean fish, yeah.
So there you are. You're hanging out with us.
Yeah.
We're like, oh my gosh, look what we caught. And we cut it up. Where would you fall on that? Would you be like, no way, bro? Or would you say the risk is so small, I will enjoy it with you?
I'd enjoy it with you.
Oh, okay. So we're not like stupid for having done that.
No, I've eaten. I've been to Taiwan, and I've had, when they bring in the giant tuna, and it's a ceremony. The chief chef there slices it, and everybody's looking. The newspapers and television's there. This is worth $10,000, this giant tuna. And it's wonderful fish.
Okay. So you're not. So
because we can't.
You know everything you know, and you would still eat.
Yeah, because that parasite can't do any real damage to us.
Really?
Not really. It can it wander around you a little bit, and see, especially there's some fish like hake. You know about hake?
Yeah, I'm familiar with hake.
Or merluza, it's sometimes called, or some monkfish, for example. These are the really tasty fish, or even some of the flatfish too, like you mentioned, dovasole and these fish are sometimes very wormy, but cook them and they're fine. But if you don't cook them, it's not the end of the world.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we can move on. Freshwater fish.
Freshwater fish. Okay. In this country, the only real freshwater fish you're going to worry about is a tapeworm.
No, back up, because you're Canadian.
I'm sorry, North America.
Okay, good.
As opposed to Southeast Asia.
Yeah, all right. We'll go with North America.
North America. Is a worm. It's called a long name, Diphyllobothrium latum. It's almost as long. It'll grow up to about 10 meters, 10 yards long, almost the whole length of your intestine.
Yeah, I put a story in my article about this, about a guy who pulled 5 feet of one out of his own.
Yeah, this is freshwater fish. And you know where a lot has been written on in Jewish housewives?
Okay.
Would make a thing called gefilte fish.
Oh, yeah, man.
Fish balls, sort of stewed.
White fish, pike, carp.
White fish, exactly. Yeah. And what she would do before she boiled them in the liquid, she would taste it to make sure there's enough salt in it. Either too much or not enough salt, add it. But she would taste the raw fish. She was the one in the family who got this tapeworm, and the rest of the family didn't, because they had it after these things were boiled in the fish sauce, fish stew. So, this particular worm, though, is a bit objectionable when people say, you know, a 10 yards long worm. It's not going to cause much of a problem. You might have one inside you now and not even know it. If you're well fed, you've got enough food to feed you and a couple of these worms.
More than well fed.
So it can eat. So that worm can live for a while.
I can live for a long time.
But he can't reproduce.
Yep. It can reproduce in you. You, as you defecate, you're going to leave little, what they call proglottids, little tiny bits of ribbony tape come out with your feces. And if that gets, in this particular case, gets into the water course, then there's an intermediate, usually a mollusk, a small snail, so a little creature, is the intermediate host. And the fish eats that thing and it gets the
I'm confused now, because this big ass, the 10 meter worm.
Yeah.
You get it from what? What fish can you get it from?
Freshwater fish.
But this thing doesn't exist in salt water.
Well, it does if the fish lives in both waters.
Oh,
so yeah. Salmon are the one-two punch.
Yeah. Salmon and char.
So why were you saying eels. That? Okay, yes. if this one can get in you and it can live in you and it can reproduce, but it's not reproducing
in you. It's fertilizing another one of the same species, and you're excreting out the bits. So you can't get it reproducing in within you as an isolated unit. You see,
but there's no detrimental effect from this thing.
Not really. If you were really malnourished, you know, it'd be difficult to keep a couple of these worms going. Tapeworms are not really dangerous. I mean, they're...
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Huh. Yeah, so...
Sam's got one of these?
Likely.
No. But yeah, salmon is one... And we had a conference of businessmen. I think they were in northern British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of their conference, they wanted to taste... Because from all over the world, they wanted to taste British Columbia fresh salmon. It was smoked not in the Northwest Pacific style, you know, which is where you hot smoke it. This is the traditional cold smoking.
Yep.
And I think four or five of these businessmen came down with both the marine worms and the tapeworm. It's about the only fish that will happen to.
Okay, came down in what way? How did they know?
They had a serology that showed that they'd been attacked by these little marine worms.
But they weren't sick and didn't die.
No, they had some pains. But they did have a tapeworm, and that showed up as well. And eventually, the stool samples showed that it was there as well. But it's a very unusual case where you get both kinds of parasite, and the only fish that'll work with is Arctic char, which is a member of the salmon family, or any of the salmons. And
there was
we think eel as well, but we haven't seen examples of that yet. But we think eel would work.
I just had Arctic char raw several weeks ago when I was in Iceland.
Yeah, eel, quick little lesson, my favorite word is catadrinous.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody knows anadromous fish, which live in the ocean and spawn in the rivers, but eels live in the rivers and spawn in the ocean. We had a little scare at my house recently where all of a sudden everybody's all excited because one of my kids had defecated out a bunch of real thin tapeworms. So I went out to investigate.
You sure they were tapeworms?
No. Well, you know what he was eating? We had made summer sausage and put it in a collagen casing. And I sliced a bunch for him, and I didn't realize that he didn't know to take the casing off.
Uh-huh.
But it's cutting these discs, and he's eating these things all day long. And he eats I don't know how many chunks of collagen sausage casing, which he then passes out. You look in the bowl, and it looks like. I'm like, what? I looked at him, and I kept looking. I'm like, what? And I went and got a pair of latex gloves, and I pulled them out. All these rings of collagen sausage casing.
Well, what you will get, and I've had them, people calling up and saying, quickly, come over, look in the toilet. And there's somebody who's been on the toilet, and down the toilet, there's a bunch of moving worms.
Yeah.
Spaghetti kind of worms.
Okay.
And they're all roundworms, and some are about 5 inches long, and some are about 7 inches long.
Real worms?
Real worms.
Okay.
And these are Ascaris lumbricoides. These are the roundworm called Ascaris.
Oh, the kids get playing in sandboxes.
Well, that's one way of doing it. And these worms can plug up your intestine. They're so dense. I've taken a pig intestine when I used to be an inspector in the slaughterhouse, sliced through the intestine, and no food could really get through it because you've just cut through about 27 little worms at the same time just to have through the intestine.
No kidding.
So these people are in a really bad way. I mean, they're not digesting any food, and they're all bloated and edematous and so on. Yeah.
How do they get that?
They get that through eating on the food. The cystic eggs of this particular worm. There was a village in Scotland going back to about 1930, I think it was, isolated little village. And the physician, I think, retired for some reason. And the new physician came along. And the first morning in the waiting room, the first patient came in. And he said, how are you today? And the woman said, oh, just the usual cough. Coughed up a few worms, just the usual, nothing much. And he said, when you're coughing up worms. It turned out the whole village had Ascaris worms in them. And they were seeding themselves. Why? Because they were using night soilage, you know? They were collecting sewage in their houses in buckets and putting it on the gardens and growing vegetables.
Oh, there you go.
Oh. And so this is. Then we had a couple of scientists, I think they were German, who decided to experiment on themselves, good scientists, and they seeded some strawberries in a strawberry patch 1 year with Ascaris eggs. And then every year they ate about a pound or so of strawberries. And every year for about 5 or 6 years, both of them got Ascaris worms. So these things can live for a number of years through frost cycles. The eggs can, because they're almost really dried up like a spore. So these things are around, but normally in the food that we eat, we don't have dirt. You know, we found them on paper money.
No kidding.
Coins.
You know, I was just yelling at my kid 2 days ago to stop. He had a $5 bill he's running around with in his mouth.
Don't do that.
I was telling him, I was like, man, don't put money in your mouth. And he's like, why? I'm like, I don't know. I just understand that it's something you're not supposed to do.
what you should do in the States is have what we have in Canada, plastic money.
We're not that far along yet.
Plastic money, see? You can put it in a washing machine.
It's all different sizes, though.
We like to be able to burn our money. Really.
Yeah, I know. You put it in a washing machine, it'll still be in the pocket when you come out. Don't iron it, though. It melts.
Okay, good to know.
Man, it's good stuff. I had a thought, but I can't remember what my thought was.
I got a thought.
Oh.
I want to hear about some of the nastier worms and the flukes. I was reading about a village or community in Thailand, I believe, that has an extremely high prevalence of liver cancer due to some raw fish preparation that involves live red ants, but there's some liver fluke in their regional fishes. But I'm just talking about...
You lost me.
Okay.
They're getting sick from eating ants, or they're sick from eating liver flukes?
Liver flukes in fish. Ants, that's tangential. Liver that's flukes, what they thought it was initially.
Oh, they're like, oh, you're all sick because you're eating too many ants.
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of things there. That's why I said Southeast Asia just a while.
I was coming back to it.
There are a number of flukes there, including Clonorchis sinensis, the Chinese liver fluke, which is a very... One of the intermediate hosts for this is a crab. It's a marine crab. It's called the mitten crab.
Mm-hmm.
Because the adult, on its claws, it's got algae that grows just like big hairy mittens.
Okay.
Now, I've eaten this crab when I was in Shanghai and Hong Kong. It's the sweetest crab meat you'll ever meet. It's delicious. But you've got to cook it because it's carrying the larval form of the liver fluke, which gets into your liver, into your bile ducts, and it can cause all kinds of problems with your liver. And of course, that irritation or inflammation is by definition an early form of what we would call promoters in cancer. If you have any kind of inflammation, it can lead to a cancer later down the road, not it will. So this is one, and we found that fish farming, the kind of fish farming they do in the Philippines and Southeast Asia, there's a lot of liver flukes coming out of that. So you've got to cook the fish. And of course, my relatives and so on in Hong Kong, they don't like to cook. They like the freshest possible seafood and shrimps and lobsters. They'll undercook it deliberately because they want that fresh, just like your bear meat.
How do you have relatives in Hong Kong?
My third wife is from Hong Kong.
You've been married three times.
Yes.
You still married to her now?
Nope.
Really? Real quick, we'll get back to what we're talking about. What do you think makes it so? How are you so difficult to live with?
Oh, I don't know. It's I probably talk about worms all the time, creepy crawlies, slimy things. You know.
Oh man, that's terrible. Not terrible. I mean, you're fine and everything. I just think about like. I'd hate to have to, you know, like my buddy Ronnie once said, man, he goes, I don't want to lose half my stuff, but
I have great in-laws all over the world now, international.
That's convenient.
Look at the positives. We were talking about the Philippines. One of the more, you'll appreciate this story as someone who specializes in foodborne pathogens. We hiked into a village in the Philippines one time, like not on the road system at all. You had to hike way into the mountains. In the highlands of Luzon, the main island.
Yep.
And I slept in a house one night where the house is built on pilings, built on stilts. And they had like portions of the house were like widely spaced planks. The reason the house is on pilings, as best I could tell, is below the house was a pen. And the pen is where they fattened dogs and pigs.
Hmm.
And so all human waste and all food scrap just would go through the floor down to the dogs and pigs, which you then consumed. And I'm not a squeamish person, but I remember having just a feeling of like, this seems like a good place for me to get sick. Hanging out like in this proximity to sort of like just watching like the recycling of human excrement.
The parallel to that is in some areas around the coast of some countries in Southeast Asia, they do the same thing with fish farming, where the fish is kept in a pen right underneath the house on stilts.
So all the waste
is going down there. When you think about it, I mean, the pig has got an amazing alimentary canal, and the pig eats its own waste and the waste from other animals as well, because it's in fact extracting the food that the original eater left behind. And the pig can use that, and the pig puts on weight because of
that. What's the term alimentary canal?
Alimentary canal.
What does that mean?
From the mouth to the uranus. It's the whole canal.
And what's the word?
Alimentary. Not elementary, A-L.
Oh, never heard that word. What does it mean?
It's that canal where you digest and assimilate food.
So that in and of itself is that. That's not an adjective.
Oh, no. Well, okay. It's an adjective for canal, yeah.
Okay. And it has an amazing one of these.
Yeah. Very effective, a pig.
Because you're saying like something else can eat and pass. Mm-hmm. And not absorb nutrients from them, but they can eat those mm-hmm. droppings and pick up his like sloppy seconds or whatever you want
exactly,
to call it.
Exactly. So again, if there's cooking done properly, and people aren't eating raw pork in China.
Are not?
No. Okay. It's sometimes you get a lot of raw meats in Cambodia and Vietnam, but China, they cook even lettuce. They cook lettuce. And this is why it's pretty much about the safest food to eat is properly done Chinese food. It's all cooked.
Yeah.
And this is the lesson with our hunting fraternity. Either boil it or bake it or stop something biting you and wash your hands, just like Granny told us. All the way, you know, the wisdom is there. Do that, you won't get trichinosis or any of these tapeworms either.
You know what else happened in the same Philippine village that I thought was a cool system and didn't make me feel like I was going to get sick? Is that they had terraced, they were in the very steep mountains and they had terraced rice paddies that they'd built over thousands of years. And their rotational system mm-hmm. would be that they'd sow rice and farm rice. And then when one of the paddies came out of a rice harvest, they would do tilapia. They would do fish in it, flood mm-hmm. it, and mm-hmm. do fish in it as like a regenerative mm-hmm. practice. Harvest the fish, drain the thing out, and then do a rice crop in there.
Yeah.
To fertilize the...
And they're also feeding the fish as well. They got to feed the fish. And of course, the fish droppings accumulate and the remains of the food, that's the nitrogen for the next crop of rice.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful cyclical thing. I mean, it should delight all the organic farmers in this part of the world. They don't call it organic in that part of the world.
It's called farming.
It's farming, yeah. We've often said organic farming is really the rich people showing off what they can do. It's nothing to do with reality.
Yeah, for sure. Let's do toxoplasmosis because our buddy, he's supposed to be dropping by today.
Mm-hmm.
One of our buddy's wives, man, I think she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Toxoplasmosis.
Really? Stay away from cats then. She should stay away from cats.
But you get
she's
it.
She's pregnant.
But you can get it from eating game meat, right?
Yep.
Talk about, this is one of these ones I don't even know. I don't understand what the hell it is.
Okay, now we're leaving bacteria behind now. We're into the area of a parasite.
Is that okay?
A single-celled parasite. Yeah. Toxoplasma gondii.
It's not named after Gandhi. Oh, no, it's different.
No, Gondi, G-O-N-D-I. Okay. Double I. Do you remember when Dr. Christian Barnard, you may not remember, you were too young. If you're old as me, you remember. He was the first guy who did the heart transplant in South Africa.
No recollection.
And he was on a...
He was the first guy to perform one?
Perform one.
Okay.
And so he was doing a study tour. I think he was in Harvard, I think it was, and one of the New England medical schools. And all the medical students were there wanting to hear Dr. Barnard talk about this first time ever heart transplant. The break came. They rushed across the road. They were starving.
Do you remember roughly what year that would have been?
Probably about 1972 or something like that.
Okay.
And they rushed across the road to a little hamburger guy, and they swarmed
1967.
67. Okay, I'm a few years later. And he couldn't keep up the hamburgers. And they kicked, quick, got to get back. So he was half cooking the hamburgers.
I got lost.
Everybody,
who's eating burgers?
This medical students who come to this lecture. They swarmed across the road to the hamburger seller, who was quickly half cooking them and giving them to the medical students.
Oh, he's got a rush.
Who went back in. Right.
He's got a mad rush.
It turned out that some 4 or 5 or 6 of these people developed toxoplasmosis from the raw hamburger.
Okay.
It doesn't usually happen with beef. It's usually other animals, but, you know, and sometimes your hamburger isn't hamburger. It's other meats as well mixed in. So that, for a while, became known as Barnard syndrome, where medical students developed something from eating hamburger. But back to your original question.
Named after the guy that performed the first heart surgery.
Yeah, because he was there locally. Giving a lecture.
Only
that's
locally.
Unfortunate.
Dude, he's got to be like, that guy's got to be like, yeah, come on, man.
Come on.
Anyway,
let's call it burger syndrome.
This little parasite is, they've recently rewritten some of the medical books because of this. What happened in British Columbia, in Victoria? Let me back up a little bit. The main reservoir for this organism is cats. All of the Felidae, where the wild cats...
I knew I didn't like cats.
Well, no, if you like them or not, it doesn't matter. They carry this thing around with them, and they defecate. And if it's, for example, taken in for a human body, it doesn't normally cause anything too nasty. But if you're pregnant... And in the early stages of pregnancy, this thing can mess up the barrier, and it can end up with some pretty nasty deformities and unfortunate things for the infant. So women should keep away from that. We had an outbreak in Victoria, you know, the beautiful capital city, Vancouver Island.
Spent a lot of time there.
And these were an outbreak of toxoplasmosis among people who had never had raw meat, never had game meat, never kept cats. Where the hell were they getting it from? Long story short, it was the boil down to the water. And the water was in a reservoir above the city in the highland. And they traced it back. And the cougars, wildcats, mountain lions.
Pumas.
They get there, cougars.
Catamounts.
Well, whatever you call them.
Painters.
In Canada, they call them cougars. They had toxoplasma. They were defecating around the beach area of the reservoir. These little things were entering the water. Now, Victoria filters and chlorinates its water, like every good city does. But the filtering may have let some of these through, and the chlorine was not enough. This is the big thing about these things.
Whoa.
Normal chlorine will kill bacteria. It won't kill these parasites. You need to treble the amount of chlorine in the water. Oof. So it's getting it through. Now, if you look in the Communicable Diseases book, it said it can't be transmitted through water that's been contaminated by cats' feces.
That's really interesting. So the main way of getting it isn't eating deer meat.
It can be. It can be eating. Very often it's domestic meat, but deer meat.
Oh,
yep,
so people get toxoplasmosis from domestic meat.
Yeah, cows, sheep, mutton, sometimes pork, deer, moose. Yep.
Does that die at a certain temperature?
Oh, yeah, you can kill it. Obviously. It doesn't spore forms. It forms spores. What am I talking about now? It doesn't form spores. You can kill it at a normal cooking temperature. We'll do that again, about 160 again for Fahrenheit.
Magic 160.
Yep, absolutely, because it's the denatures of protein. But best not to tangle it with if you've got pregnant women around.
What is...
I should tell you an interesting story about this, too.
Please.
This parasite is one of those that's been studied... to see how it affects the victim. You may have come across it. It's almost science fiction, where mice are affected with Toxoplasma gondii, they behave in a reckless way. They come out and they almost like pull in faces at the cat if you paint a silly picture. In other words, can you see the logic here? They're almost asking to be eaten and to regenerate their cycle again. We've seen this in
interesting.
I think we've seen this in some fungus, which we don't get in North America. Claviceps would be one of those. It grows in China, in the mountain areas of Nepal. The fungus inoculates a larva, a worm. The worm then does something strange. It climbs up on a blade of grass, dies, and then the fungus consumes the worm and forms little sporing bodies that forms the spore. In other words, it
It drives it up to a good place for dispersal.
So Mother Nature, you see, never underestimate the power of Mother Nature.
So like kamikaze mice.
Oh, here we go.
That's not probably not the right way.
I started to write a story, actually, about this affecting humans. It's like a fictitious story, but I never got beyond the first chapter yet. But I may dig it up.
A lot of stories go like that. You think you got something good, but you just don't feel like doing it.
Oh, yeah.
You guys good on that one?
Yes.
Toxoplasmosis. Rabies.
Oh, dear. Do you have rabies here? I'm sure you do.
Me?
I mean, in Montana.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, is there places that don't have rabies?
Some places more than others. We, Ontario, we have some of the highest density of rabies anywhere in North America.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Because we're surrounded by lakes and rivers and two sides of a triangle. So all these wildlife are in there, the pressure of the wildlife and cities and so on. So we get, every health district has got families taking shots all the time. Rabies, yep.
Let's start out with what it is.
Okay, a viral disease.
It's a virus.
A virus.
Okay.
It's a lysavirus. It's got a number of relatives, but they're all deadly. For all intents and purposes, they're 100% fatal. Nobody survives. But the curious thing about it, it's one of the few diseases that you can still use a vaccine after you've been infected. Normally, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, because in the old days, like not even the old days, not that long ago, when you got rabies, man, it was like you were in trouble. Isn't that correct?
Well, if you no treatment, you died. That's the trouble you're in.
Do you know, do you guys, in Canada, you guys probably aren't really huge into Daniel Boone. Are you familiar with Daniel Boone?
The name rings a bell.
Yeah.
Walt Disney made a movie, I think, didn't
That's right, but yeah. You guys be doing yourselves a favor to get into Daniel Boone. But Boone was in one of his camps one time, a guy... There was a bunch of guys sleeping around a fire in one of Boone's camps. They had just been in a skirmish with some Indians, and they were kind of regrouping. But anyways, a wolf came in and was, as they tell, like the wolf was kind of like very fixated on one person for whatever reason. And this guy got bit on the head or face. I can't remember where he got bit. He was sleeping. Got bit on the head or face. Some months go by, and they're night hunting on the Clinch River. They just drift the rivers at night with torches. And the guy has this outbreak of hydrophobia and goes berserk. The guy, his hunting partner, has to actually jump out of the canoe to get away from the guy who's going berserk with hydrophobia. The episode ends. He's so afraid of he's going to hurt somebody that he instructs his friends to tie him up. And they bind him up and take him home. And then he has another big outbreak, whatever you call it, and dies.
From the first symptom to the death wouldn't be more than 10 days, 11 days at the most.
Really?
Always. So if they did get him home, it would have been within a day or two.
And the story as it's told is that the bite healed, had enough time to heal before he had his first instance of like, intense hydrophobia.
Oh, it'll always do.
Okay.
See, this is a very strange disease. You get bitten by a rabid dog or a wolf or a coyote or a fox or a bat or anything like this. The bite inoculates you with a virus.
Okay.
Now, the virus doesn't affect where it is. There's sometimes a bit of swelling there, but it soon heals up and you think, oh, that's fine. Meanwhile, the virus is now working its way toward your central nervous system. Upper spinal cord and brain especially. And it can take, depending on where you're bitten, bitten on the big toe, it can take many months, 6-7 months. Bitten on the leg or something, a knee, maybe 4-5 months. Bitten around the shoulder, the neck, the face, maybe a few weeks.
Shorter distance to travel.
Right. Once it gets to the brain, then the encephalitis starts, the brain inflammation starts. Also, the parotid glands, these salivary glands at the side, become very heavily loaded with virus. And that's when the symptoms start. The symptoms, you call it hydrophobia. That's what Pasteur called it, actually.
Is that not accurate?
What is hydrophobia?
Hydrophobia is when the symptoms begin, the throat becomes extreme. You've had a strep sore throat. We'll magnify that by about 50 times. The throat is on fire. Whoa. It's closed. You can't drink anything, and you're dying of starvation. You see a glass of water, you try and sip, and the pain is unbearable. So you want the water, but the pain is all incredible. So it looks like you're afraid of water. You're afraid of touching it because of the pain. It's nothing to do with the fear of water. It's just because of the pain.
But why was it of note to the guys? I think that I can't remember his name. The guy there's a historian that collected up a lot of these narratives. I can't remember his name, but it was of note in the story that they were out in a canoe on the river when the guy had an episode.
Nothing to do with it. I mean, other than the fact that he might have tried to drink the river water, which you can do, of course, and that's maybe when he first felt this horrible pain in the throat.
Okay. Yeah, I got
but
you.
Any water will do it. But you die in a thirst. You're burning up because of the fever and the thirst, and you touch water and it's agony. That's why it looks like it's... However, look at the beauty of this. You've got to look at the beauty of it, right?
I am. Trying.
The saliva from the salivary glands becomes loaded with virus.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the saliva that's in your mouth, you can't swallow. We're always swallowing saliva. There you can't. It's plugged up. So you're drooling. You're foaming.
Frothing at the mouth.
Frothing at the mouth. And that's where the virus is. Right? Now bring in the aggressive form of rabies. Sometimes there's a dumb form where you just sort of go in the corner and become a vegetable, but more often you become aggressive. And if it's a wild animal, it's got no fear of any other thing either. A fox come out of the brush and give you a bite. You know, mm-hmm. Never do that normally. So now you've got the aggression, the bite, the saliva full of virus, and the cycle starts again. It's just a perfect, perfect storm, if you like.
Do squirrels carry rabies?
Any animal can carry rabies. We even found it in mice. A laboratory, you can inoculate an animal. But remember that it's going to get it from being in a conflict with another animal.
Yeah.
The small animals would die and be eaten, usually.
Reason I bring that up, let me tell you quick something that happened to me.
There has been positive squirrels, though.
We were in a pool one time out on the end of in the Hamptons. You familiar with the Hamptons Island? We're in a pool, and a squirrel comes running up. I was in there with my kids, our friends' kids. Everybody's in the pool. Squirrel comes running up and starts running up and down the side of the pool frantically, kind of casing everybody out.
Mm-hmm.
Yee.
Then the squirrel jumps into the pool. And I think, well, he's not going to like that. But then he starts coming at people in the pool swimming. And I grabbed him up by the tail and whooped him so hard that it killed him. Do you think that... We always wondered, like, what his, what kind of trip he was on.
Could have been. This happened before with squirrels.
Yeah.
In fact, just a matter of about 2 or 3 weeks ago only, there were 2 episodes with foxes, almost the same as you're saying. They're both in the eastern part of the United States.
Okay.
Where in one case, a woman was walking or jogging, I think it was, and a fox came out of the undergrowth and went straight for her and bit her. And here she is sort of wondering what the hell to do. And then the neighbor's dog, I think, came along and chased the fox away and killed it. And eventually the head was found to be positive. This is what caused rabies in this fox.
So did the dog die too? No, the dog was probably vaccinated.
The dog could then get the shots.
Gotcha.
Right? In that intervening period between the bite and going up to the brain.
Yeah.
So the person who has rabies, getting back to your guy in the canoe, if he had bitten somebody, it's possible that he could have passed it on. But of course, humans don't normally get to the point of biting other humans. But technically, there's no reason why it wouldn't happen.
Why are the bulk of rabies cases, why do they come from bats?
Not the majority. No, if you go to Asia, the majority is dogs.
Oh.
Feral dogs, wild dogs, stray dogs. In North America, it's really raccoons, skunks, foxes, bats. That's about it. In Central America, it's bats and cattle. Because you get
cattle.
Cattle, because you're looking at the bats that eat, that drink blood.
Vampire bats.
And they'll bite the cattle around the ankles. Next thing you know, the cow has got rabies. And the
but who's he going to bite?
It doesn't, but the cow obviously is in trouble. It can't feed. It doesn't. The farmer says it hasn't fed for a while. It's behaving normally. The vet comes and says something's stuck in its throat. So you know what vets do? They put the big long and the throat. Nothing in there. But now the vet gets bitten, And the vet has to take the shots. The cow was rabid, but you didn't think of that.
A rabid cow.
A rabid cow. So any animal can be rabid. In fact, we didn't have raccoon rabies in Ontario, in Canada, until some bright spark brought up a semi-trailer from, I think it was Georgia, full of raccoons. Because somebody up there wanted to go hunting raccoons in New England, Maine, and Vermont. And they didn't have many raccoons there. So they said, let's bring some up from Georgia. So they brought up, and apparently they brought up some rabid ones. So next thing we know, that crossing over the bridges into Canada, along right Brockville area, we're getting raccoon rabies appearing. So what they tried there was something that's now been picked up in the United States. They trapped and killed every for 1 kilometer. It's about a half a mile. And then around for 10 kilometers, that's about 4 miles, they dropped rabies vaccine baits in the form of meatballs.
Yeah, there's a whole line in the U.S. where they use those.
And that's where they started using it. It's so successful, they're now doing it in the States all over the place.
Yeah, there's like some line. You guys know where the line runs? Through the eastern U.S. somewhere, north to south, I think. Yeah. There's like a line where they airdrop rabies vaccination.
Either Ohio or Pennsylvania, somewhere like that.
Yeah. Pennsylvania sticks in my mouth. Can't remember where. Remember we talked to that he's a wildlife disease specialist. Brian Richards was telling us about that.
Yeah. All I remember is that it was done on the East Coast.
Okay, let's talk about...
What do you mean bats? I finished with bats, though, because bats have some extra problem with a bat.
You have an extra problem with bats?
Yeah, we have extra problems. We think that the bats possibly can spread the virus as an aerosol. Now, that really gets you worried, because normally you need to have a bite. Most physicians will say, let me see your leg. Have you actually been bitten by the animal? And they got to see a little puncture mark or something.
Okay.
But with a bat, we have some evidence to show that a bat flying around a bedroom, terrifying the people in the house, can possibly spread by aerosol.
Just his saliva.
Saliva in the air. And not only that, the bat's teeth are so needle-like, that people have woken up, not the Canada, but the States, woken up and there's been a bat sitting on the chest somewhere. They wake up and the bat flies away. And they really looked closely and they didn't know, but they could actually see a little tiny mark on the skin with the teeth.
Oh,
that's a rough way to wake
up. So that's tough for the bat. And also, last thing with the bat, we think it can live longer in its infective stage. Normally, remember about the dog or the other animal?
Yeah.
10 days maximum. Between the symptoms, the infective start, you're dead, it's usually 5 or 6 or 7 days, less than 10. Bat, we think, can be longer than that.
So that creates like a little extra.
Yeah, and if you don't like bats, that's okay. But look, bats spread SARS. You remember SARS back in 2003?
Yeah.
Yep.
We thought it was a thing called a civet cat. It wasn't. The civet cat got it from bats in China. Huh. Ebola, Ebola?
Sure.
From bats.
Man, right? If any listeners already didn't like bats, they're really going to hate bats.
Well, yeah, but bats are hurting, man.
Well, yeah, they are.
They are with their blue, white nose syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah, my kids just went on a tour of a bat cave.
Yeah.
Well, Lewis and Clark Caverns, which has bats in it. They went on a tour, and the tour people were curious what all caves they'd been in. And if you'd been in another cave or something like that, you couldn't go in this cave.
Really?
Yeah. They hadn't been in any, I don't know if they reported.
They put their N95 masks on in the cave?
You know, it's hard to get information from little kids.
Mm.
But I got the gist of it. But, they could have messed something up. But I do believe them that someone inquired about what other cave and they've been involved in.
Because there's a lot of fungus and things that can grow in the bat guano on the floor of the cave.
Yeah, and that's what kills. There's like this, what's it called again, Sam?
White nose syndrome.
Yeah, white nose syndrome.
Yeah, white nose syndrome. But there's also some other stuff, like histoplasmosis, for example, which can grow in that. Hmm. There's another single-celled, like toxoplasma, which can be inhaled. Lung disease.
Are you comfortable coming back on the show sometime?
Yeah, we got a lot to talk about.
Well, because we're not going to get through all the diseases, man.
No, not even close.
I want to hit
I think we got to hit Giardia.
Okay, go on. Yeah.
Giardia.
No,
yeah.
Let's do Giardia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because that's very, it's right now. People are going into the woods. They've got their Steripens. They've got their water filters.
Here?
Well, I have a friend who
I
have a friend who just got the campylobacteriosis.
Oh, campylobacteria.
From water, drinking water out hunting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about drinking water out in the woods.
Okay, drinking water in the woods. Okay, so Jada would come into that in a big way. Single-celled parasite now. If you look at it in the way that most textbooks look at it, it looks like a little balloon with two big eyes. These are actually suckering discs.
Oh, sounds cute.
It sounds really cute.
Yeah.
You say it looks like a balloon with two big eyes?
Yeah, like a pear-shaped thing with okay. two eyes in there.
But it's not eyes.
They're not eyes. They're actually sucking discs. They're resistant to chlorine. And if you go, a colleague of mine does a lot of work in the far north of Canada, up there in research in the tundra, you know, where the Eskimos are, the Inuit.
Yeah.
And almost everybody has had giardiasis at some point or another.
Well, that contradicts what I've been told by people, is that when you get up to the Arctic slope, you don't have it anymore.
Oh, no, that's not true. No, there's all kinds of giardia up there.
Oh, okay.
It's living quite happily. Now, it doesn't kill you off usually, but it causes a lot of chronic intestinal problems.
Oh, we've all had it, man.
Chronic. Yeah. It foul-smelling diarrhea that keeps starts and stops.
You get all burpy. You get burpy.
Oh, yeah. And it's not continuous, but so it can be treated. There's a number of good anti-parasitic preparations, but some of them are as bad as a parasite.
My brother once said that he almost thought it was worth getting giardia because of the relief the medication brought. He was like, giardia medicine and Tums and acid. Antacid are like two medicines that he likes because you take it and all of a sudden you feel a lot better. And he really appreciated.
That's like the logic of hitting head against a brick wall, you know, and stopping. The joy of stopping. No, giardia is spreading, and it's hardly anybody's free of it. Hardly anybody's immune to it. It's gonna if you're out there with the water that's not been boiled properly, boiling will kill it.
How long?
Oh, even bringing it to boiling point, I'd say a minute or two, but to be on the safe side, about 5 minutes. And you cool it down again, you're safe as anything. Nothing will happen. But of course, what's the container you're going to put it in? If you're going to use it for something else, where have your hands been? I mean, you know, there's a chain of infection going along here.
Yeah.
And it's in the environment. I mean, every bit of fresh water or plant you may pick out of the fresh water, fish you've pulled out of the mud or something, that's where the giardia is.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, and I accept what you're saying, but people that get it, it's like you can dip your toothbrush all day long in some creek and brush your teeth. And, you know, anyone that dips their toothbrush in a creek usually knows not to, they spit it all out.
Yeah, yeah.
The people that get it, and I've gotten it, and when I've gotten it, you're able to look and be like, you were drinking volumes of water. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anyone that picked up Cryptosporidia or Giardia that couldn't look and figure out what, like, couldn't look and sort of isolate a situation where they made a stupid call. Hmm. Like, do you hear of patients coming in, or people coming in with Giardia and having no idea how they could have possibly gotten it? Haven't been camping?
No,
you don't go fishing and wind up with Giardia.
If you go, no, that's true. But going fishing is entering the great wild world where you are associated with something or other there. I mean, where do you go fishing and don't have lunch on the bank of the river or the lake or something? You're going to stop for lunch, or you're going to cook up some fish, and in so doing, you've maybe brought some other stuff around. And usually, I agree with you. It's a larger quantity. It's a glass of water. Or the people in Milwaukee who had it piped through in their town system.
Is that right?
Really?
And this was the biggest single outbreak of crypto. This is crypto now, but they're almost a parallel in the way they affect you.
Okay.
In history.
In the municipal water system.
Municipal water supply.
Oh, I got you.
Milwaukee. And
all had beaver fever right in town.
Oh, the experts were there. And of course, the lab people weren't trained to look for crypto. They were looking for bacteria. And they did every test for bacteria under the sun. They said, we can't find anything in there. And eventually, it was a hot summer day, and it was up to about 50,000 illnesses cases, and something like 5,000 deaths. This is a big outbreak.
When was this?
I'm surprised you never heard about it. Oh, I can get you the exact date when they get.
I feel like I remember some kind of listeria outbreak or something like that.
That's listeria is always much smaller than that, but more deadly. Anyway, this particular thing, they had a big press conference. And the reporters were there, and the commissioner for health forget his name now, Schmidt or something like that. One of the reporters said, Dr. Schmidt, we noticed that you're not drinking your water on the press table, you know. And he said, well, to tell the truth, a couple of boys in the lab think that it might be something to do with the water, but we're not sure yet. Now, up to that point, they thought it was food.
Yeah.
And so the lawyers went to town and said, look, if you think it's something to do with water, at least tell us and we'll boil the water until you find out what the hell's going on. It was very embarrassing.
Oh. This was in 1993.
Early 90s.
Yeah.
That would
do. I was just out of high school.
Modern
man.
Times.
800,000 people were exposed to it.
No.
Exposure was huge, yeah. Because it was coming to the safe water supply, you know, drinking fountains, school kids.
Wow.
Man.
And again, that's a parasite that resists the chlorination that we normally apply. So you've got to have an extra special chlorine or extra special filtration.
So back to somebody that's out camping.
Out camping.
And they stop.
But hold on, can I hit one more before you
sure.
do that? Did you watch that documentary about that cult in Oregon called Wild Wild? Was it Wild Wild Country or Wild Country?
Wild Wild Country.
Wild Wild Country. It's a documentary about this cult in Oregon. And they had it where they're trying to figure out a way to keep everybody from voting on a certain day. They didn't want the townspeople to vote because they wanted to be able to dominate an election. So they think, how can we get – what would prevent everybody from voting? And they feel that what would prevent everybody from voting is that everyone were sick.
Oh, Jesus.
And they experimented – their experiment with various – they were going into salad bars. There was like a popular restaurant in town. And they went and tried to like contaminate a salad bar and effectively did it and got a bunch of people sick. But another thing they knew about –
This is a true story.
No, it's a true story.
Yeah, the Rajneeshis.
So they knew about beaver fever, but they didn't quite know what beaver fever was. They thought that somehow like beavers had carried beaver fever. And they didn't execute on this, but I think they toyed with this plan to catch beavers and then blend the beavers up and contaminate the municipal water supply with blended up beavers in order to infect the townspeople so that on election day, only the Rajneeshis would vote. It's a great story. Anyway, go ahead, Yanni.
Thank you for that.
Take a big blender.
A big blender,
like,
yeah.
Go get me a beaver and a beaver, big blender.
Beaver blender.
And the reason I'm bringing up this instance, because I've been there and I've had, and I can't quite remember now what he's a chemical engineer, I believe, but a scientist nonetheless. And when I sat there and went through pumping my water, treating it, and I was actually using one of these Nalgene bottles, just like this one. And I would put my one end right into the creek there, the water source, and it sort of has like a real rough filter at that end, and it kind of has a float to keep it up off the bottom, and so you stay away from the sediment. Goes in one tube, goes through the filter, and then there's a
ceramic filter, right?
No, it wasn't a ceramic version. It was just the catted in, the regular filter, but not a ceramic version. Okay. And then you put the little attachment that fits nice and snug on your Nalgene bottle. You proceed to pump away.
Oh, it's a reverse osmosis then?
Yes.
Okay, with the pressure.
Yeah.
Through a membrane.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And you pump it full. And then when it's all said and done, I would take my water filtration system and there's, you know, long tubes going both directions, and I would wrap it up and put it back into my little pouch that it lives in, put it into my backpack, and off we go. And he felt that because I'm not keeping the whole system clean, and that in the end I'm sort of contaminating the whole system because that one end that goes into the water source is now stuck in a bag, and you splash little droplets of water in there. He's like, you know what? If you're going to do that, there's really no reason for us to sit here and spend all this time filtering the water.
Bullshit, man. It's got to be some kind of parts per million, man. The whole world would have Giardia.
Well, aren't there parts of the world that where like great percentage of people have it
in poor areas? Yeah.
Yeah,
like the north of Canada, where they're living in like a third world area for sure. Wells and sewage all get a bit mixed up together, that kind of thing for sure.
Yeah,
but let's stay with the water again, because you mentioned about water treatment systems. if you're looking for a system, reverse osmosis is not a bad system, but it's got some real problems with it. When it's working out of the manufacturer, and if it's NSF certified to be 1 micron, it's got to be absolute, says on it, absolute 1 micron, then it's been tested by the National Sanitation Foundation. It's been found not to pass anything greater than 1 microphone. So you're going to keep out crypto and Giardia.
And viruses too, right? At 1 micron?
No.
No? Okay.
Much smaller. Much smaller. Even some of the bacteria will get through at 1 micron. But if you're just looking at these particular nasties, if it says nominal 1 micron, don't trust it. That'll sometimes 20 to 30% of the crypto will get through with nominal. It's just like approximately.
Sure.
So go with your absolute. The other thing with RO is it works very well until the membrane, which is a semi-permeable membrane, until that gets even a microscopic hole in it, which it will do after a while. It's a biological membrane. So you get a little fungus growing in it, little pinholes in it, and there's no way to tell that what water's getting through is in fact contaminated. So they normally say use an RO filter with something downstream from it, like ozone or a little drop of chlorine or something in there as well, just to be sure that there's something in there. Same with the ultraviolet light. You remember for a while there were little ultraviolet light kits you could get?
That's what we use now. That's all we use now.
Now, the problem with ultraviolet is that it forms a deposit on the tube. You know, if you have a tube within the tube, if it's one of those.
Yeah, we have a tube within a tube.
If you take it out once in a while, you don't clean the inner tube. There's all kinds of a caking on the inner tube, which means that your UV now doesn't reach the water, and there's no way to tell. So what you should do is either clean that inner tube rigorously every time, or make sure there's something downstream like chlorine or iodine or something like that, or ozone, which will polish off anything that's got by.
Yeah, we're big Steripen guys.
Really?
Yeah,
well, that's good. Yeah,
that's the product, the name of it. Yeah, we love it.
It runs on like a CR123 battery.
Yeah,
or double A's. They have both versions.
Right. I like those. And hey, how does iodine kill stuff?
Well, it's a molecule that actually an element that when in combination with proteins it forms a not a very pleasant situation. This is why iodine was the first thing that you dab on. You remember in the old days?
Oh, sure, man. Your mom and dad dumping that red stuff on you all the time.
It wasn't the iodine that hurt. It was the alcohol it was in, because it was a tincture of iodine.
Okay.
But nowadays you use betadine and these other things which you can put on. It doesn't hurt as much. So you go for an operation. They put on that nice red stuff.
Yeah.
Let it dry and then they cut into you. But it's an iota 4. Or an iodine complicated organic iodine compound. It's just that it kills off most bacteria. Most bacteria can't survive in it. Just
but it's okay to, like, because here's the thing, like, you know, guys in the military, they use a lot of iodine.
For
water sanitation. In the field.
Okay. Yep.
Right? So you use iodine tablets.
Yep.
And then they make a neutralizer
that
neutralizes the flavor of iodine.
Yeah.
But it's a commonly held belief, I don't know if it's true or not, and like in our circles, it's a commonly held belief that if you're spending a ton of time out, you shouldn't be using iodine because you're drinking all this. You're drinking too much iodine.
The only place in your body that will hang on to iodine is your thyroid gland.
Okay.
No other tissue has got a receptor point for it. So anything more than that, you urinated, you defecated straight out. So you can't really do much. I believe there is a threshold for too much iodine. It sort of interplays hell with the irritation in some parts of the system, and also can give too much in the thyroid gland. But it's not going to be something that's going to affect you too much.
So if you're spending you spend a couple months out of the year out running around the woods,
it's the taste that most people don't like.
So there's no detriment. There's not not every day, all day, but like a week here and there. Drinking iodine-treated water is okay.
Let me talk to our occupational health people who are linked in with OSHA and NIOSH and so on, just to see what the latest is on excessive iodine.
Yeah.
And what is excessive? I mean, it's got to be several ounces of iodine or something. Was it just a little more? Let me find out that, and I can forward that information to you.
Yeah. When I was talking earlier about, I got two more GR, or two more like water.
Because remember, salt's got iodine in, because we need iodine.
Yeah.
They put iodine in salt because they figure it's mass medication, but it's the one thing you could guarantee that everybody's going to have a little bit of salt in their year, their month, their week.
My two remaining questions on Giardia and crypto and other waterborne stuff that you get when you're camping. Back to my one point, like I've had it two or three times. And when like I remember one time I could take you to where I drank out of a creek rabbit hunting back home in Michigan and got real sick. And then I got it one time in Arizona because I did iodine, but I didn't want to, I was super thirsty and I didn't want to wait for the iodine tablet to dissolve. And everybody else thought it was really stupid. And I had some argument why I thought it was okay. Got sick. I remember my brother, him getting it real bad one time because we were elk hunting and we found where we thought we found a trickle, the original source where it's coming out of the ground. And he drank a bunch of that. And then we went another 10 yards up the hill and realized that it was a big elk wallow. And it hadn't flown through enough sand to filter it out.
Yeah.
And I remember he got sick and it went on and on and on and eventually got treated. So, like, the times when we've had it and then were diagnosed because of giving a scat sample have again, it's been these times when you like get sick, you're like, oh man, did I make a bad move? I remember another time a bunch of us got sick in Colorado because someone had told us that some river was for some magical reason didn't have it. Everybody drank, everybody got sick.
Colorado's a hot spot.
Is it really? Mm. And it was just like all these moments where you could kind of go through your history over the last couple of weeks and sort of identify, you know, a moment where it came from. So to Giannis, like driving after, mainly I'm driving after Giannis's point where when I hear people talk about that, you know, you dip some water out of a creek and then you stare pen the inside of your bottle, how maybe you missed a little drop in the threads of the bottle. I don't know, man. I just feel like if that stuff was getting you, then everybody'd be sick all the damn time.
It's a probability game, really, on how many of the cells you're taking in. And all those things we've talked about, whether it's tularemia and toxoplasma and so on, there's a minimum number of cells you need to get ill. Okay. With some of these things, you need 500,000 or 750,000 to get ill. Other things, half a dozen will do it.
Gotcha.
So it all really depends on what the density is in the water.
And probably your fitness or your wellness, right?
To some degree, or your immune system, let's call it that. How strong your immune system. For example, if you're pretty ill from some other underlying feature, or you've got diabetes or something, maybe your immune system is down, you're going to be hit much harder than other people.
So here's my second question. Were communities or groups of First Nations peoples, Native American, Native Alaskans, did they eventually develop a immunity to it? And did all of their children have to go through a phase of having Giardia?
That is a really good question. And we've had the same thing asked about things like Salmonella in Mexico, for example, or in Southeast Asia, where there's a lot of it around, but people don't seem to suffer from it anywhere near as much as the tourist who goes there and is exposed. We know that, before I leave Salmonella a little bit, we know that Salmonella typhi, which causes a rather strange form of Salmonella we call typhoid fever, which is a very serious
disease. I didn't know that was even connected. Okay.
It's called Salmonella typhi. That particular organism, we've had a vaccine. I haven't been vaccinated for that when I used to live in the Mediterranean, typhoid fever and paratyphoid fever. So the other Salmonella probably do. We even think there's a link like that, a kind of an acquired immunity among local people with Staphylococcus aureus, the staph toxin. You get, you know, that there's not an organism. The organism produces the toxin, and we eat the toxin. Even that appears that some people might actually become not immune to it, but tolerant of it, more tolerant of it. They wouldn't suffer from it. And so travelers coming back from the nice North American city, their stomach is used to North American supermarket food. They go and travel in Thailand or Philippines or somewhere like that, and they suddenly are really ill. The local people are eating it all the time. I don't know about Giardia, specifically about that, but it's such a good question. I want to find out and get back to you about that because I want to see if there's any evidence so far that we can become more tolerant of Giardia. I think it's a really good bet that we do.
Good. So hang on that because we're going to wrap it up and I'm going to let you go because now we have occasion to have you back on and provide us the answer about how Native Americans coped with Giardia. Good?
Sounds good.
You got any, what do you guys got? You got any concluders?
I just want to make sure that I'm clear that my takeaway is that it is okay for me to go out there and eat as much fresh or saltwater fish raw. And that
he wants you to write it down that it's okay.
The worst thing that's going to happen to me is that I'm going to end up with a little worm that crawls through my stomach and worms around for up to a week or so and then dies.
In the kind of fish we're going to be exposed to in North America, yes. That's about right.
Okay.
So ceviche, there's a number of societies around the world who do the same thing.
Sure.
Oddly enough, they call it cooking in lime. It's because the appearance of the fish, you know, it looks like it's cooked.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Goes opaque. Yeah. But it's not actually being cooked. I think that like the chlorine or anything else, it's the time and the dose. So it's the strength of the lime and how long it's been in there to achieve a kill off of the anything that is in there. But even if it wasn't much in there, what you're saying is still true. You're not going to have any serious disease. You may have some little tickle in the throat. You may get a little puncture in the intestine. If you're really rare, you might get a peritonitis, but that's so rare that it hits the medical books when it happens. So it's not a big deal.
Oh, it's really rare enough that people write about it when it happens?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's a good measure of rarity.
Good.
It's like when someone gets hit by a mountain lion, it makes national news. You're like, not many people are getting hit by mountain lions.
Yeah, very true.
Unless the mountain lion had toxoplasma in it, you know.
Yeah, that's another kind of mountain lion problem. Sam, what do you got?
Oh, I mean, there's so many more diseases I want to talk about from this incredible list
you gave us. But we're not going to get through them all.
I
thought we had a chance to get through them all, I would plow ahead.
I know.
But it's got to be a TB. It's to be continued, man. It's like how Dukes of Hazzard.
I understand. I'm just so fascinated now. And I'm struggling with kind of dueling emotions that, like, I feel, like, authorized to go eat whatever fish I went to raw, but I'm also like scared to death now about a bunch of other shit. So,
but I wouldn't do that in Southeast Asia.
I wasn't planning on it.
Fish and crab and shrimp cooked there.
Yeah.
But I mean, there was a thing in Hong Kong a number of years ago where I was with people who do that, who they would bring live shrimp to the table. And you pick them up with the chopsticks, and maybe you dunk them quickly into the hot soup, but they're still basically alive. Eat them.
Yeah, there's a handful. There's a place in L.A. I went to, and the whole special, the whole point there is like eating stuff that's alive.
Yeah.
I mean, people eat raw oysters.
Oysters you eat alive, yeah.
Yeah, but like there's more stuff. They're bringing all this stuff out. It's like the whole thing is, it's still alive. Yeah, isn't that great?
And in an oyster, if you look really closely before you eat it, there's all kinds of little worms in there, but they don't cause any problem at all. Look at it closely.
I mean, you know, I don't know if you're a fillet of bluegill or perch. It looks like someone put black pepper on them already. I don't tell my wife. I'm like, see that? That's a couple hundred little worms.
I'll make sure it's properly cooked.
That's a parasite.
No, I just like, yeah, they just look like that. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
What they do is in some places in Europe and England, they take a haddock, a sea fish, and they smoke it. It's called smoked haddock.
Yeah.
But the worms now take on more of the dye than the fish does. So at last, anybody looking at it, you say, oh, there's a little coiled up because it's dark amber color, and the rest of the fish is light amber color.
No
but
shit.
It's dead. It's been properly cooked.
Hey, you don't have a book or anything, do you?
I'm writing a couple of things, yeah.
So if people are listening and they want to check out, I mean, you probably publish academically, right?
Oh, academically publishing, yeah. But I do. I'm a writer on Quora now. I'm retired from full-time teaching, but I still do some teaching around the world.
So people can look up Tim Sly.
Tim Sly Ryerson, and then you'll get all kinds of...
Epidemiologist, and people will find your work and be able to read your stuff.
I read a great deal of his writings, completely unrelated to even anything I was writing about, and your responses on Quora always have a good tongue-in-cheek component that I enjoyed quite a bit.
Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Steve.
I'd love to have you back.
Okay.
We only got through not even about a third of the things a fella could run into. we haven't touched on babesiosis, brucellosis.
I'd never even heard of that one.
Campylobacteriosis.
Babesiosis.
Anaplasmosis. Stay tuned, folks. We're going to cover a lot more diseases that'll kill you. Thanks again.
Good stuff. Pleasure.